This morning, I want to look at a Bible story in Genesis. But before we look at that Bible story together, because I used to be a literature teacher for middle school and high school, there are some literary terms that I want to review really quickly. And this might bring up some painful memories for you, just like I was getting memories of Hillsborough Friends Church this morning. These might be a different kind of memory. Actually, there are three words that I want to go over: symbol, motif, and trope. And you might actually know exactly what all three of those are, but I want to make sure we're all on the same page. A symbol is usually, not always, it's usually an object that carries some significance beyond itself as an object. So if you're reading an Agatha Christie novel and there is a candlestick on the mantle that is described with great detail, that's going to be important later. That's a symbol. It's also foreshadowing, but that's not on my list, so we're not going to get into that. It's an object that carries some significance, and the significance might not be obvious. The significance might be profound. It might be multi-layered. It also might be pretty simple. The symbol might just remind you of a character. For instance, if you smell a particular brand of cigar, you might know that you're reading a book that has Hercule Poirot as the detective. That's a symbol, an object that carries significance greater than itself. A motif is if that symbol begins to show up as a pattern, and every time the symbol gains a little bit more weight than it had before, that's a motif. So a motif, like if you're sewing, you might just have a recurring theme that shows up through the garment that kind of tells a story. In a story, you might have an object that keeps on showing up in different contexts and reminds you of the last time you saw it, and it might hint at how the story is developing. It might help you to know what's coming. There's foreshadowing again. I should have put that on the list. So a symbol is an object with greater significance than itself. A motif is when that object keeps on showing up and a pattern begins to develop. A trope is something like a recurring cultural pattern. So it's more than just an object. It's more like there's an exchange between people, and that kind of exchange keeps on reverberating through the entire story. It happens again and again. Or you recognize an exchange in a TV show and you remember it from a movie that you saw and you know what it means in this TV show. Maybe they've pulled that from another piece of culture in order to give you some insight into what's coming, or in order to make the story more efficient. They don't have to explain all the backstory if you know the trope, if you already know how it works. So for instance, if I'm reading an Agatha Christie novel and one of the characters says, I guess you're all wondering why I've gathered you here together. You know that they're about to reveal some really important details about how the murder occurred. That's a trope. A trope is it's a pretty simple kind of thing, and you might even use it as a joke. You might say at the beginning of a committee meeting, I guess you're all wondering why I've gathered you here together. And people might laugh because it's out of context and it's kind of silly, but it reminds them of this story that you all, and someone who isn't from your culture might have no idea what's happening. It's almost like an idiom. It just doesn't make sense if they don't have that shared experience. So symbols, motifs, and tropes can also be used to help us figure out who's part of our group and who's not. The thing about the Bible is that it has symbols, motifs, and tropes that we don't immediately recognize because we're not actually part of the in-group. And Paul makes this clear in Romans when he says that we're grafted in to the original olive tree, that we have been given access to a community that wasn't designed for us, but that now has space for us. And that's actually one of the miracles that Jesus wrought through his sacrifice, was that we now get to be on the inside, we who were outsiders. I want to talk about, just as an example, a couple different symbols. One is a boat. The symbol of a boat shows up all the way through Scripture in really important ways. The boat is almost always a symbol of salvation. The boat saves us from drowning, except for it's not a literal drowning. It's also saving the world, saving humanity, saving creation. So we have the boat in the story of Noah, where Noah and his family are on a boat for 40 days. And they are saved from God's wrath, and the world is saved through Noah's family. We have a little basket boat in the story of Moses, a baby who's saved because his sister is quick-thinking and hides him in a basket and then floats him out so that he can be picked up by the curious princess of the Pharaoh, who then is going to adopt him. And because he's saved, God's people are later saved. That's also a salvation story. We have Jonah on a boat in a storm, and Jonah offering to be thrown overboard, sacrificing his life so that everybody on the boat might be saved. Another salvation story, and also kind of some foreshadowing of Jesus. We have Jesus on a boat, asleep. Like, what's he doing asleep on a boat with his head on a pillow while his disciples are battling a storm and potential death? They wake Jesus up, and Jesus saves them by uttering a word to the storm, be quiet or be calm. We have Paul on a boat, reassuring all of the people with him, but especially the centurion, that no lives will be lost. And the boat shipwrecks, and they end up on Malta, and they're able to warm their hands over a warm fire. And so this boat shows up as a symbol, but also as a motif, reminding us that salvation is at hand. God saves. God provides. God is with us. Another symbol you might be familiar with is the number 12. We have the 12 tribes of Israel. We have the concubine in Judges, whose body, after she's killed, is cut into 12 pieces. Very gory story. Similarly, Saul, his oxen, he slaughters them and cuts them into 12 pieces. But then in the New Testament, we have Jesus redeeming these stories, and we have the 12 baskets left over of bread. And at the Last Supper, Jesus then tying the stories together as he hands out the wine and bread to his 12 apostles and says, take and eat, identifying himself both as the 12 basketfuls left over. Jesus is going to supply everything that we need, in fact, more than we need. And also identifying himself with the concubine. Here's my body, the 12 pieces of it, take and eat. So symbols in the Bible are actually pretty important. And these motifs can tell us what to do with stories that otherwise are maybe a little bit mysterious or beyond our understanding. And when we end up with a trope, two stories might be powerfully tied together that otherwise we would think of as completely separate, having nothing to do with each other. So I want to read a story. And it involves some repeated symbols, there's a motif, and there's definitely a trope. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to go through some of the parallels between this story and another story, because they're not accidental. And you've probably had an English teacher tell you this before. And maybe you were the kind of student who thought, oh, they're reading too much into things. Why do they have to take every good story and turn it into work? Because that's what English teachers do, isn't it? But they really want you to be capable of reading these same kinds of situations in the larger culture, because symbols, motifs, and tropes show up in our politics. They're issues of justice. They show up in the ways that our family dynamics work, and they might be issues of dysfunction that we need to be able to read so that we can make sure we're not repeating them. They show up in our relationships. They show up in our community. They don't just show up in literature, but literature is a powerful metaphor for life. And so sometimes when we study these symbols or motifs and tropes in literature, even though it's kind of boring when you're in high school or in junior high doing this, it gives us some critical thinking tools that allow us to read our culture, to read our family, to read our community, and to choose something different from what we've been given or what we've ended up with. Here's the story. It's in Genesis 9, starting in verse 18. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who were scattered over the earth. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, there's some time that's passed between verses 20 and 21. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. The lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave." This is not a very good story. And it reveals that Noah, who was considered righteous and who was used to save all of humanity, who was commanded to build a boat and was promised by God, given a promise that was just for him, that the whole world would be saved and that God would never destroy it again. Noah is given the promise of the rainbow. Noah is given the blueprints for the ark. Noah is given the command to be fruitful and multiply and fill up the earth. The same command that had previously been given to Adam is now given to Noah. God is renewing creation. God is making a new world through Noah. And yet Noah is a dirty old drunk who can't keep his clothes on and who curses his grandson who might not yet have even been born. This is a confusing story. It's a dark story. And it's the kind of story that when I was in Sunday school, we didn't spend very much time on. I was homeschooled. We were reading through the Bible a chapter at a time. And I remember asking my mom about this story. And I remember her answer not making sense, which actually, that's the kind of thing, that was a trope in our family. Eric has a question that makes my mom uncomfortable, and so we move on. She doesn't feel qualified to tackle the question, and she doesn't want to shut it down, and so we move on. This is actually a story that has stuck with me for a long time, and there are some really interesting things happening in this story. But before I get into any of those interesting things that might actually be more trivia than religiously important, before I get into any of those things, I want to demonstrate how this story is actually a retelling of an older story. And that this seems to be intentional. Yahweh planted a garden, Eden, at the beginning of creation. And now, at the beginning of a new creation, Noah plants a vineyard, or in some versions of the Bible, an orchard. Adam and Eve consume fruit in that garden and are filled with shame. They hide from God as a result. Noah consumes fruit and gets drunk, but has no shame. Adam and Eve recognize that they're naked. And not only are they afraid now of God, but they also hide, apparently, separate from each other. Noah also gets naked. Adam and Eve are clothed by God. God, recognizing that their innocence is gone, and you can't regain innocence once it's lost. That just doesn't happen. Not without significant brain surgery. And that doesn't really, I shouldn't have said that. That's not funny. I'm sorry. You cannot regain innocence. Adam and Eve are clothed by God. Noah is covered with a garment by his sons. Adam and Eve's eyes are opened to their condition. Noah wakes up and becomes aware of what's happened. A curse is put on Adam and Eve. Noah puts a curse on his unborn grandson, Canaan, the son of Ham. Ham is the one who did the deed. Ham doesn't suffer any consequences. And so one of the things that I find when I recognize the trope, is that it actually makes the story even more complex. Initially, the story is just troubling. I thought Noah was a good person. Why is all this happening? Now, as I see that this story is a reflection of or a shadow of another story, I realize, ooh, this is actually a lot more complicated than I thought it was. This new creation, it's not going so well. And there are some problems with the way that the characters are interacting. They don't quite make sense. So here's some of the trivia that I think helps us to put this story in perspective, even though it doesn't resolve the story for us. One piece of trivia is that in this story, there's some euphemistic language that's used to cover up what's actually happening in the story. When it says that Ham sees his father's nakedness, and then we hear the curse at the end, Ham is being treated as a murderer. And even to the second and a third generation, his family is cursed. That gives biblical scholars a clue that Ham didn't just look on his father, he did something. And we have no idea what that was. I mean, our imagination takes us pretty far, and our imagination might actually take us too far. But Ham probably actually did something. He didn't just look. And that's one of the problems in this story. The second little bit of trivia that we have that helps us to understand what this story is for is that it's the grandson that's cursed, not the son. And it's specifically Canaan. Ham has four children that we know of, four boys who are named, and only one of them is cursed. And the curse is very specific, that Canaan will be a slave to the progeny of Noah's other two sons. Biblical scholars are pretty positive, almost completely in accord about the place of this story. They say that this is a form of early political propaganda, that what this story does for an Israel that is a monarchy and that is under threat, that it helps Israel to offer some background for why things are the way that they are. These people, the Canaanites, we took their land, but God gave that to us way back when. That this story might not necessarily be a historical narrative. This story might be more a political narrative. That creates a little bit of a problem for me as a Christian, because I think of the Bible as scripture, as holy, as sacred, and I do not think of politics as holy ground. So one of the challenges for me as a Christian is, are there some aspects in my culture that I think of as just secular that are also sacred? In other words, should my politics be a sacred or holy practice? Should I be considering what God is calling me to do in the world, how God is calling me to be in the world, and how that might be a challenge to the political sphere in which I live and operate? There's another aspect of this. How do I feel about propaganda being in the Bible? Am I okay with that? What am I going to do with that? If nothing else, it challenges my idea of what the Bible is. The Bible's a collection of literature from human beings crossing thousands of years, dealing with real problems, and maybe, every once in a while, making up a story in order to prove a point. On the face of it, the point that this story proves is one that I don't like very much. I don't think that it's okay to justify slavery, or to justify domination, or to justify violence. But I do recognize that even if the author of the story didn't intend it, there are some themes in here. I didn't cover that word, sorry. There are some themes in this story that are actually Christian. One of them has to do with the way that we deal with sex and shame in our culture. In the story of Adam and Eve, they recognize that they're naked and they feel shame, and that shame separates them from each other and separates them from God. Noah, when he's naked and drunk, is vulnerable. And Noah is taken advantage of by one of his children. And he responds not with shame but with violence, and I know that that is actually a common human response to shame. I don't know how many of you remember Kathy Knox from when she and Roger were here at Silverton. Kathy and my mom grew up as next-door neighbors. And not only were they next-door neighbors, they went to elementary school together. My mom is 1 year younger than Kathy, and Kathy, even though they were not initially related, Kathy always treated my mom like she was her older sister, because my mom was an only child, and My mom's dad was paralyzed, and my mom would walk to school with Kathy, and she would go to Sunday school with Kathy. When my mom was 5 years old and got mad at my grandmother and ran away from home, she went to the park and she climbed a tree, and she probably pouted up there thinking about how sad she wanted her mom to be that she was gone. Kathy brought my mom food in the park. Their relationship was such that my mom for years would say, I don't know if she loved me or if she didn't want me to come home. And maybe a little bit of both. They were little kids and they fought a lot. There was one fight in particular that that Kathy brought up. She and I met this last week to talk about a family cookbook that she's been working on for a long time. And she asked me if I'd heard this story, and I'd only ever heard parts of it. But apparently, when Kathy was in third grade, she developed an interest in a boy. I don't remember what the boy's name was, but everybody could tell that Kathy liked this boy, but she didn't know that. She thought that she had been very sophisticated and careful about talking to him or being nearby at recess or about the things that she wrote down or drew or doodled when she was thinking about him. But my mom noticed. And my mom, at every opportunity, brought it up with Kathy. And they had gotten to a point where they had come home from school and they were in the yard in front of my mom's house next to Kathy's house. And my mom was shouting, screaming probably, this boy's name. And Kathy felt shame. Well, Kathy had in her hand a tin lunchbox, a metal lunchbox. And she did this with her arm, which might not be very effective when a third grader does that. And then she got close enough to let go of it and have it hit my mom in the head. I don't know how many of you have been in situations like that. Maybe you've been hit by the lunchbox. Maybe you've also thrown the lunchbox. Maybe you have caused someone else to feel shame because you've made them vulnerable. Maybe you've also been caused to feel shame because of your own vulnerability. My mom didn't tease Kathy about that boy again. Kathy also lost interest in that boy. I don't know if that surprises anybody. And life went on. But I think that with this story that appears on the face of it to be political propaganda that's somehow been stuck in the middle of what we consider sacred, I think that this story does tell the truth, maybe in spite of its author's intention. It tells the truth about human frailty. Noah drinks more than he should, and maybe he shouldn't have drunk anything at all. Noah does not act responsibly when he's under the influence. Noah is taken advantage of in his vulnerability. This does not mean that Noah is a perfect person, that someone else comes along and victimizes him. That does not make him a good person, but he was victimized. He was taken advantage of. And Noah responds, he reacts, he overreacts in his anger. And curses not his son, not the real culprit. Instead, he curses someone who's absolutely no threat to him. This is something that I think we do too. Sometimes it's safer to hit your brother than it is to yell at your mom. Sometimes it's safer to take that thing that you're angry about and to displace it or to replace it onto somebody else who you know can't hurt you if they decide to retaliate. And so I think that a question that this story potentially challenges us with is not just what are we going to do about the fact that this story is in the Bible. I think that a more important question for us might be, in our own lives, in our own families, in our own communities, how do we break this pattern of shame and separation or of shame and violence? How do we break this pattern? God, thank you. Thank you for your love. Even as you gave Adam and Eve something brand new, a fresh beginning. And then helped them recover when things didn't go right. Even as you gave Noah a brand new chance at life and everything that he needed to live in abundance, we know that you do the same for us. God, I ask that you would help us to live with this tension, to struggle with this question of how to break that connection between shame and violence or shame and separation so that we might get better at being together, that we might become partners with you in creating families that are different, a church that is different, a community that is more whole, more united, more loving. And God, I ask that you'd help us to do that work inside ourselves too. Teach us to be vulnerable without fear. Help us to respond in love whenever we can. Amen.
Thank you, Eric, for a really great message today. That was very touching. I think there's something that always kind of fascinated me was a term synonyms and how you can exchange one word for another and it doesn't do any damage to the meaning of the sentence or the thought. And love and trust you can exchange whenever you see it and it doesn't change anything. And the opposite of love is fear. And when we get hurt, we're afraid and we draw back. And then that's what damages our community because we fear each other, we don't trust. And so that's kind of the way back. But the reason we're simple creatures don't know the future, don't know what holds, you know, so we don't know if we can trust somebody or not because we don't know what the future is. But if we're with the Lord, future is with him, so why not trust everybody? Because it's just makes sense. I love Pastor Bob and his benedictions. They were good because he always started with God's not angry with you. Well, that's good because there's a lot to be angry about, isn't he? So, I took this benediction from Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. And I'll say, God's not angry with you. And this is my take on that scripture. May you grow to love and accept the you God is making you to be. May you walk in a new level of grace and gratitude that gives you peace and leaves others encouraged. May you be more apt to look forward with hope than you are to look back with regret. May your heart spill over with joy at the very thought of the story God is writing in your life. As you go along this week, remember to do unto others as you would they do unto you.